Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage neurosurgeon Dr. Marius Maxwell of the Arctic Spine Clinic here in Anchorage. We're going to be discussing some surgical advances of the spine and perhaps even have time to talk about some suggestions for spine health. If you have questions or comments or experiences you would like to share with us, let me tell you how you can get in touch over the next hour. Our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as always, you can email us during the program over the next hour at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Maxwell, it's just a pleasure to have you join us today.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for the invitation.
So we have not met before. You're a relative newcomer. There are lots of newcomers, but not a lot of new neurosurgeons. Tell us a little bit about yourself. And I always like to have listeners understand what it's like to become a neurosurgeon, what the training is. But I'll prep you on or prime you on that when the time comes. But bring us up to date about how you got here.
Well, I'd first say don't do it. It's a long, long training. It took me 20 years from beginning medical school to leaving my residency. Yep. In hindsight, I wouldn't and couldn't have done much else with my life, so I'm happy about it, but I can see why people don't. Uh-huh. I was born in India. My father was a journalist there. I grew up in India and left when I was about 8. Spent my formative years in England with several years in high school in the great nation of Australia, and then back to England for university. My great love really was for the United States, and as soon as the ink was dry on my medical degree from Cambridge, I came over to Harvard, Mass General, one of the big hospitals at Harvard, and got a research fellowship. I didn't know it then, but it would be 14 years before I finally would leave, so... Mm. It's a long, long time.
Yeah. And in the middle of doing and working and getting a PhD, you got interested in neurosurgery?
Well, I arrived actually my mind back at the office of the great former professor of neurosurgery, Nick Zervas, who is now the emeritus. And I insisted that I have an audience with a great man. His secretary wouldn't let me, so I waited for 3 days. And on the third day, I was ushered in. And told him that I wanted a research fellowship at his great institution, and surprisingly, I got one. So It was a funny peripatetic journey.
So you were doing a neurosurgery training program, and coincident with that started this PhD?
My aim at that stage was to study neurosurgery, I decided that I have to study at Harvard for some reason. My brother was studying in Boston. And in order to get into the more competitive residencies in the USA, you have to spend your time in a lab and demonstrate your worth. Mm-hmm. So I spent a few years in the lab in those days doing molecular biology of brain tumors. Now, it seems like yesterday, but it was back in the mid to late 80s, and this was the dawn of a new beginning in cancer biology, the discovery of oncogenes, proto-oncogenes, and growth factors. Mm-hmm. And so I got off on a bit of a sidetrack. I got a PhD and then I rerouted myself. I decided that if I was in search of truth, academia was not where I'd find it. And I got back to clinical medicine, luckily got into that very prestigious residency training program.
Right.
And emerged blinking into the sunlight 14 years later.
So... let's focus just a little bit then on that residency program. When I was in training in the 70s, there were a couple of neurosurgeons in my training program who were on every other night. And what I remember is they never even got started till midnight. Not a pleasant experience, very demanding.
You know, most of the, you had such a sense of disbelief when you got in. Mass General, you know, takes 2 people a year, right. And I think, you know, out of several hundred. Right. So I just had such a sense of disbelief that I actually made it. And I can still remember our first day as general surgical interns in the Ether Dome, which was one of the first places in this country where ether was used as general anesthetic, that a very old Harvard professor of general surgery came into the auditorium and said, you know, ladies and gentlemen, get down on your hands and knees and thank God that you made it into Mass General Hospital. And so we felt, you know, a great sense of being a very special cadre.
Right.
But yeah, these were the old years. I think in about after I finished, they changed the hours for residents along the lines of airline pilots, long-distance truck drivers.
Right.
So we did do every other night call for many, many years, but it's all we knew. And we all wanted to get through the tunnel. And in order to emerge on the other side, you had to swim through it. So it was a long time, but for many years, you wouldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel, and then suddenly blinding, it would be it was upon you, and you found yourself at the farewell chief residence dinner. Bizarre. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. You look back at what you've done. I was, for a period of time, doing every third night in private practice, which was, looking back, I don't know how I did that, because there was an obstetrician in town who invariably had to do a C-section at midnight every night. It's, I don't know when he slept, but so the next day, you know, you're wiped out, and then you can recover, and then you're on call again. I don't know how you surgeons do it. And you're right. And so now there are rules about how much physicians or training can work. But in private practice, you're still going pretty good at night.
Practice,
and there's
yeah.
no rules that say you can't do it.
That's
like
true.
Pilots.
And part of it is that's the game. If you sign up for it, then do it with pride.
Yeah.
But certainly the residencies were quite draconian in the old days. Now they're much, much easier. But still, they're pretty taxing. But
so what is a neurosurgeon? What are you doing most now? What is your interest? Tell us about what you're doing at the Spine Center.
Well, Arctic Spine is a practice that I started last year. I've been wanting to come to Alaska, actually, since I was a child. I'm a falconer, a big lover of nature and wild animals, and Alaska has always piqued my imagination. And so this is the culmination of a many, many decades' dream to come and live and work here. I basically am a general neurosurgeon. I do a whole range of cranial surgery, but in our practice, we specialize on spine.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
Well, for neurosurgeons in the USA, spine is about 90% of the patient load that you'll see. So it's partly the demographics, only at academic centers, if you subspecialize in, let's say, skull base or vascular, can you have an entirely cranial practice. So in private practice, it's usually the break is something like 90% spine, 10% cranial, plus or minus.
Let me take just a second, Dr. Maxwell, and remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from KSKA Anchorage. My guest today is Anchorage neurosurgeon Dr. Marius Maxwell. He is the owner of Arctic Spine Clinic. He's, as you just heard, relatively new to town and has an extensively well-done training in the area of neurosurgery. We're going to try to focus on his area of particular interest, which is the area of the spine and some of the newer technology that has allowed spine surgery to advance, and also get a little bit of philosophy about how to approach people with any health problem, but particularly with some spine issues. If you've got questions or comments, here's how you can get in touch with us during the next 45 minutes or so. Our local number, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And if you're out of town and you need a toll-free number, it's 1-888-353-5752. So what's happened to improve spine surgery other than training programs, which have improved our ability to get better trained surgeons? Has the technology changed significantly?
Well, as we were speaking prior to coming on air, there's been an explosion of minimally invasive surgical techniques since the 80s, really. And now with miniaturization of optics and cameras, they're reaching a new reality. I'm not really here to mindlessly extol science for the sake of science. I think it's critically important that the one variable in the equation is the surgeon that you choose.
What do you mean?
By that I mean the annals of medicine are replete with flashes in the pan, new technologies that are new in the 70s, new in the 80s, but then through 10 years of trial and practice fall away. Mm-hmm. And I am a big believer in the necessity of patients to educate themselves. It's a bewildering, I hate to use the word marketplace, but it's a bewildering environment for a patient with back pain to navigate. He'll be bombarded by ads on TV, by internet ads extolling laser surgery, minimally invasive surgery. And something in the many years I've been doing this, probably the same period that you've been practicing medicine, is something that alarms me is I always quip that most people spend more time worrying about the ins and outs of their new GMC pickup truck than having spine surgery. Mm. And that is that, you know, people are put themselves in the hands of a spine surgeon or a pain management doctor and expect that the best options will be given to them. Mm-hmm. And I just try to express to my patients, I try and urge them to be skeptical of anything that I tell them, to verify that. The Romans had the term caveat emptor, buyer beware. Right. Even people in agonizing back pain who are clearly desperate for a painless remedy are completely unaware of the fact that their pain can get dramatically worse after surgery, after the wrong surgery, or after the right surgery with complications. So, as I say, my GMC pickup quip is quite real. I think people should spend more time researching their doctor and researching the options that the doctor is presenting to them.
Well, the most well-intentioned of all of us can get into a trap, and that's why I've kind of promoted the idea of science in here as evidence. And let me see if I'm following your train of thought with a classic error in medicine, error in medicine, that is pretty well known. And that was, I don't remember when it was, probably in the 70s, it was felt that if you ligated the internal mammary artery in the chest, it helped angina. Right. It made angina get better. And that was a surgery that began to catch on, until somebody did a blinded study and showed that it didn't do anything. It was placebo effect. Somebody had surgery. They told the doctor, yeah, I feel better, when in fact, so did the group of people who had no surgery but thought they had the surgery. So I think that's what you're implying, is that we get into habits, even the best intentioned physicians, if we're not careful about looking at the evidence.
Correct. Double-blinded studies, however, it's more difficult to blind a patient to minimally invasive.
Right.
If, for example, you expect a surgeon to make an orthodox 6-inch incision in your back, when in fact you see someone approaching you with snake-like endoscope. So it's difficult to blind the surgeon and the patient. So there's been much discussion in the MIS, in the minimally invasive spine surgery world, about how to develop new parameters of evidence-based medicine for things that you can't blind against. Mm-hmm. So, leeches were much in vogue decades or centuries ago, and interestingly, they've come full circle. I think I look back on many years during my PhD, and I think it's basically made me far more skeptical of what I see in the field of spine surgery. Now, it's a fact that spine surgery in fact, the medical industry is an industry. It's the source of profits for many engineering firms. And so a busy neurosurgeon is always confronted by representatives of these companies who are trying to get you to use a new product, sometimes with the most flimsy evidence. They'll fly you out to San Diego, or you'll do a cadaver course. And sometimes you'll walk away from 2 days' experience shaking your head. You think, you know, they've just inverted or reversed customary practice in order just to do it differently. So the term reversion to the mean, I think, is something that all surgeons and medical doctors should think of, because as we navigate our way through these decades of our medical voyage, we see many false landfalls like Ulysses, many barren rocks with sirens. And I think the constant that one has to remember is if you find the right doctor and feel comfortable with finding the right doctor, someone who really, as we try and do at Arctic Spine, we're really moved by three motivations. The first is try and treat our patients as we would one of our loved ones. Now, that's easy to pay lip service to, but we really try. The second thing is always try to reach higher degrees of excellence with retraining. And thirdly, wear your compassion on your sleeve. And I think as medicine hurtles towards, you know, different payer mixes and reduced time for the doctors and everyone's being pinched, I think we see medicine being practiced by medical extenders. I hear stories of patients who have seen doctors for 5 minutes. They've seen a PA or a nurse assistant for 45 minutes, and the doctor comes in hurriedly and says, look, we'll do this surgery tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I think a patient should not accept that and should shop around, should get second opinions. A patient should always feel unhurried. If the doctor doesn't have time to sit down with you, listen to your story, listen for nuances in your story, and perform a careful physical examination, which is going to take time, there's a chance you'll be shortchanged. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason that, you know, spine surgery generically has a very bad outcome. And I think the key factor is patient selection. I think the wrong patients are getting the right surgeries, or the wrong patients are getting the wrong surgeries. So I think people have to, even though they're in pain, they may have a limb that's numb or starting to go weak, and they need to, by word of mouth or by talking to other patients, find a doctor who's really compassionate and is interested in their well-being. As obvious that may sound, I think that's the best thing.
You know, I've heard similar stories from other surgeons. We'll stick with surgeons at this point, but the same holds for non-surgeons, is that willingness to, or expectation to, really understand the patient's problem. And you put it in the perspective, or the way you said it, was to select the right patient. And you don't mean, you mean by that finding the person that can be helped by surgery for sure, and then the right kind of surgery. It's not that everybody that walks in with, you know, lumbago or radiating pain in their back is going to have the same problem and need the same therapy. You really have to sit and talk. And so a quick judgment often is a bad judgment.
That is true. I also believe, I've been doing this so long, that I don't believe in exclusivity of any particular discipline. I'm a big believer in chiropractic and physical therapy and pain management and massage therapy, in acupuncture. I've been doing this long enough that I've seen extraordinary outcomes from each of those different modalities. You know, years ago in Wyoming at a satellite clinic, I had saw two young cheerleaders with massive disc herniations at L5-S1, 16, each of them at separate patients, who I referred to local acupuncturists. They had early radiculopathies, which means they had damage to nerve with pain, numbness, and weakness in the distribution. And amazingly, those two patients, and many since then, came back smiling after a course of acupuncture. Don't ask me how it works, but it does work. So I believe in a team approach. I think that all these modalities keep millions and millions of Americans pain-free or comfortable. And I think I offer an advisory function. Many people will send me patients, and I'll say, look, this is what I think is going on, but I don't think they need surgery. Send them back to the physical therapist or chiropractor or pain management doctor. Mm-hmm. Just because a patient comes into your office doesn't mean they get surgery. So I think if patients feel they're being rushed to surgery, I think there is an epidemic of excess surgery in the USA. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to say it. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been in Anchorage almost for a year, coming on for a year in about September. And, you know, we do see, you know, I can think of one woman, hapless woman, who saw a couple of surgeons who had a cervical spine fused, a thoracic spine fused, and amazingly, her lumbar spine fused, L1 to S1, which is surgery I've never done. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you approach a doctor who uses a shotgun sort of diagnosis, you will enter a very bad part of hell. And I'm sure this woman had some pain to begin with, but as I saw her recently, I mean, she's basically crippled.
Right.
So I think, as I said before, there's a bell curve in terms of practitioners, and I think it's really incumbent upon patients to seek someone who's going to be patient, who's going to listen, who's going to examine them, and get the right imaging studies, and then give the patient a very frank, I'm often accused of being brutally frank, but I think that's what the patients need. They need your expertise to distill the options to give you a probability. You know, if you go back to your chiropractor, you'll probably be good for another year. If you have this surgery, it'll take the pain away immediately, but these are the possible complications, you know, infection, CSF leak. And I think doctors have to be brutally honest with their patients to give them the data so they make the final decision.
Let me remind listeners once again, if you have questions or comments about spine health, spine problems, new techniques in surgery, which we're going to be discussing, there's a couple ways you can get in touch with us and ask Dr. Maxwell to comment. Our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1, and you have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. Can you flesh out for us a little bit more about what you mean by minimally invasive spine surgery?
Yes, I'd be happy to. These techniques were already born in the 80s and have already come to fruition probably in the last 4 to 6 years, and they're a variety of approaches to the spine. Mainly the thoracic and lumbar spine, but also the cervical spine, the neck. And they basically involve using different sized tubes. There's one tube which is 16 to 22 millimeters, which you approach through the normal approach to the spine. Because, of course, with minimally invasive spine surgery, the object is not to tear, cut, damage the muscles, damage them by cutting them, damage them by retracting, damage them by cauterizing blood vessels, which then will die and lead to necrosis. The object is to get you to the surgical bed to perform the classic operation, but through a very small access channel. Mm-hmm. So one of the surgeries I've been doing for several years basically approaches from the same approach to the lumbar spine, for example, but through a much smaller incision, as I said, 16 to 22 millimeters. I believe in constantly challenging myself to learn new tricks. I know there's the adage about the old dog and new tricks, but I still do. I'm planning to go down to Phoenix in September to learn a technique which uses an even smaller endoscope, approximately 6 millimeters, which comes in from a lateral, what they call extraforaminal trajectory, straight into the disc, and then with tiny instruments, tiny video camera, tiny biting instruments, taking out the disc. Now, as I had mentioned to you before, only a certain percentage of patients are good candidates for minimally invasive spine surgery. And to underscore that, since I've been practicing in Alaska, I've seen a whole series of patients who've come to me having been to several centers in the lower 48 that advertise the use of lasers and this and that. And what they've had done is some patients, let's say, have a big problem. For example, multi-level spinal stenosis, which cannot be fixed through a small incision. But a lot of patients will get attracted to the advertising, have a minimally invasive procedure which doesn't really address their problem. So the caveat is that even though minimally invasive procedures are dynamically improving all the time, as we speak, they don't treat all spine problems. Mm-hmm. And a well-experienced, well-versed surgeon will have a whole series of tools in his bag to treat the patient. And sometimes minimally invasive spine surgery is the incorrect answer.
We are approaching a time where we're beginning to get some phone calls, and what I want to do is try to take our break now. We have three people holding, and I think it's a reasonable time to take this break, and then we'll start taking some of these phone calls and see where that takes us into what you're discussing with us today, Dr. Maxwell.
Okay.
So let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number, again, is 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll rejoin our guest, Anchorage neurosurgeon Dr. Marius Maxwell. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Anchorage, Alaska, station KSKA. Our local number here is 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. My guest is Anchorage neurosurgeon Dr. Marius Maxwell of the Arctic Spine Clinic, and we're discussing generally what we've been discussing so far has just been the training of neurosurgeons, some information about Dr. Maxwell in particular, some philosophy of his as approaching individuals with back pain and how a good physician may go about deciding whether or not surgery is indicated and then what kind of surgery, and at times surgery is not the right answer. So if you've got questions, our number is line one, or our email address line1@alaskapublic.org again, and our local number 550-8433. And please remember, you can listen to the program again between 9 and 10 at KSKA, but you're listening to a taped broadcast. We won't be able to answer your questions. And at any time, you can go to alaskapublic.org, hit the Line 1 link, go to our archives and listen to the program or refer someone to the program. And also, you can find the program on iTunes and their podcast link. So let's take a couple of phone calls and get this half of the show going. We'll start with Shane. You're on Line 1. What can we do for you?
I wanted to talk about the sort of preemptive medicine approach when it comes to back pain. As far as before you were to ever to consider a invasive surgery, it seems like to me, like you said, that there are too many back surgeries being performed when there could have been a couple more steps taken before then. I speak from personal experience with my father, who went from a back situation, and he was told that he was not going to be able to walk within a couple years unless he had surgery A, for example. And then, how do we sort of discourage people from just jumping onto the operating table? And then B, the second part of my question is post-surgery, with the pain levels and everything, again, from personal experience, it seemed it was with this pain management specialist and everything, it was just immediate opiates and narcotics. And we know in this country we have a lot of overprescribing of that. Not once, and I'd like to hear that the doctor with you, you embrace a lot of different aspects when it comes to chiropractic, acupuncture, this and that. But not once has anyone ever, offered my father like alternative methods such as something simple as yoga, stretching, anything like that. It just seems like the industry's really gone a lot towards these heavy narcotics. So, as far as how would you approach the preemptive surgery part? Like, how do you discourage someone from having surgery right away? And then after surgery, how do you manage the long-term chronic pain that these people are going to be in? And I'll take my answer off there.
All right, Shane. Thanks for your call.
Well, I would have liked to have asked his...
Sure. All right. Yeah, he's already been dropped. Sorry.
Okay. Obviously, I'm sorry to hear that story. Shane implied that his father had one surgery and it was unsuccessful. I'm not sure if his father's doing well now. It's a vital part of the puzzle. I think it's very important for spine surgeons to discourage surgery. What I find is patients who really need surgery don't have to be sold on the idea. I think everyone has to go through an extensive course of conservative management and should be very skeptical if they are told that they won't walk in 2 years. You know, if we had a group of neurosurgeons around the table, there'd be a lot of wry smiles, you know. I don't think I've ever told a patient that they'd be paralyzed. And we've seen some very dramatic disc herniations mm-hmm. with narrowing of the cervical canal. I think it all goes back to the fact that people have to educate themselves. They have to get second opinions. And as to the postoperative narcotics, obviously surgical pain is very, very real. And I'm constantly haranguing the surgeons at the hospitals, haranguing the nurses at the hospitals I work at to give more opiates, because when you walk through the PACU where a patient's been wheeled after surgery, I mean, you know, you'll see people in considerable pain,
right.
And that sort of pain can only be treated by opiates. And I'm known, I think, as a doctor who urges the nurses to give more, because postoperative pain is something that we can treat.
Yeah, this issue of pain medication is much, much, much more complex than I think Shane would understand. Yes, we are overusing pain medicines. Yes, we are overusing antibiotics. It is not true that you don't need pain medication at times. However, it's the selective use of it and understanding of when, I think, is what I hear you saying as well.
There's no panacea. There's no sort of zero-sum game. There's no... except acupuncture, perhaps, but mm-hmm. acupuncture, I'm sure, has a role in post-surgical patients. But sadly, everything we do has complications, with very few exceptions.
Let's address Shane's question here a little bit more about when do you need surgery and when you're not. And the way I would approach this is, what are some symptoms, what are things that patients can tell you that are strongly suggestive that surgery might be the only answer? And contrary to that, what are the symptoms that may not indicate that surgery is absolutely necessary? And I'm thinking patients think pain is the problem, and I'm betting pain is not a very good indicator of need for surgery. I'm thinking there are other indicators, but please correct me.
Well, despite, and we'll get on to imaging and how extraordinary imaging is, because
right.
if there has been one scientific revolution while I've been practicing medicine, it's only one, and it is imaging, which has revolutionized medicine from pediatrics to neurosurgery. We'll get on to that. Pain is such a subtle and difficult symptom to express. A strong working guy from the North Slope will express pain differently from a grandma in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
And so neurosurgery is really more of an art than a science, and therefore even the amazing proliferation of scientific adjuncts to the practice of neurosurgery. As I said, I'm a very, very passionate pilot. You can be flying the latest light jet with all the navigational equipment, you know, GPS, onboard color radar. But if the pilot isn't up to it, then you might as well be flying a Super Cub. So pain has to be deciphered very carefully. So to answer your question, in terms of spine surgery, if neck pain is accompanied by what we call radicular symptoms, arm pain, or if lower back pain is accompanied by leg pain, what we look for is, with progressive compromise of the nerve root, you'll get pain, then numbness, and then weakness.
Mm-hmm.
If the weakness is marked, that's usually a, quote, hard indication for surgery, because if the nerve will be damaged and will start to show it's damaged by those three things.
Mm-hmm.
If you wait too long, the weakness may never come back. The
right.
numbness may never come back.
Right.
You can live with numbness, but living with weakness is far
right.
more difficult. And there are many patients who have to wear special braces on their ankles because they lived with a ruptured lower spinal nerve, which caused a ruptured disc that pinched a nerve that caused a foot drop. So it's a very it's a subtle, it's not an easy thing. But if you're starting to have arm or leg symptoms, if obviously you're starting to have problems with your bowels or your bladder, that's a real red flag for very urgent evaluation. If you just have pain, and I don't seek to minimize it, but you should certainly always get an MRI. Ask your chiropractor, your physical therapist, or your pain management doctor to get an MRI. And I'm often surprised that the doctors are all specialists. You, Thad, are a pediatrician. I'm a neurosurgeon. I know little to nothing about pediatrics. And often I'll see someone with end-stage spinal stenosis. That means a narrowing of the lumbar spine in this instance, or cervical spine, lumbar spine, where people are virtually crippled, can only walk with a walker. And some GP or someone has opined that they don't need back surgery. So if there are findings on your MRI report which are significant, I would always at least go and see a spine surgeon for second opinion, even if your family doctor doesn't think that surgery is warranted. Sadly, we're all pigeonholed in our own areas of expertise, and sadly, we're all blind to the expertise of our colleagues in many cases.
Right. So let me make sure I'm paraphrasing you right when I say that pain, as you've implied, is so subjective, it may not be a absolute indicator of the need for surgery to anywhere near the same degree as someone perhaps less pain but is beginning to have consequences of nerve injury, such as weakness or areas of numbness in the area of distribution of certain nerves. And that would be a much more likely indication for the need for surgery rather than postponing.
That would be the likely indication for the need for neurosurgical evaluation.
Okay.
Whether you need surgery, a neurosurgeon may send you back to your physical therapist or chiropractor and say, look, you know, if things get worse, let's give Dr. Smith a chance to work with you. And quite often people are pulled back from radiculopathies over months and years to be doing just as well as they would have with a spine surgery.
And really quickly, we have a couple more people that are holding, but I want to get this question in about the accuracy of MRI in predicting with correlating with the findings on history and physical. I had a period of time where I had some significant back pain and ended up with some numbness in my leg. Observing it, waiting, getting advice about it, and during that time, I had plenty of time to read about MRIs and results, and found that in my reading that there's often, or at least some of the time, poor correlation. Some people with very abnormal-looking MRIs walked around without any problem, and some with significant pain had fairly normal-looking MRIs. So it gets back to your point, I think, if you agree with me, it's talking to the patient history. It's not just what that MRI shows you.
You're quite right. I mean, MRI can be a Pandora's box. I mean, you can have florid findings of pathology at multiple levels with a patient who has the most minimal findings. So the first adage that is beaten into a neurosurgical resident is you do not operate on the MRI, and it takes the technological know-how of a neurosurgeon to interpret the findings on the MRI and translate it to the patient's condition.
Thanks very much. Let's take another call. Bob, you're on line one.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I was wondering what Dr. Maxwell's opinion is of total disc replacement for cervical discs, and also what the longevity of those discs might be in terms of, you know, how long they might last, and if there's enough evidence out there in terms of how long they've been put in, if there's any estimate how long they might last.
Well, that's an excellent question. I'm pleased you asked that. Many years ago, approximately 12 years ago, I went down, I think it was Memphis, and spent 3 or 4 days training to put in cervical disc arthroplasties in cadavers. And it may surprise you to learn that since that time, I haven't put a single one in. The reason for that is the anterior cervical fusion, which uses bone graft in the neck, is possibly the single most successful spine surgery in abolishing the patient's symptoms, pain, numbness, weakness, and leading to a good long result. In the early days, obviously, the flexibility of the spine was deemed to be sacrosanct, and therefore a flexible disc obviously is very logical. Let me just make the caveat that I'm a neurosurgeon who does not believe in them. I'm sure you'd find some who do, but the numbers who do these days are a fraction of the numbers who used to implant them years ago. So I see that the cervical disc arthroplasty is in a decline. The body doesn't react well to artificial discs, and many studies show that a very large percentage of an implantable flexible disc becomes ossified or fused by the body in 1 or 2 years' time. And I'm sorry, I don't have the data in front of me, but I seem to recollect that the number is close to between 60% and 70%. And forgive me, I can't give you the source of that data. So if I look at it that if it was my loved ones or my family or myself, I would never have an artificial cervical disc put in me. I'd have the standard anterior cervical fusion. Having a PhD years ago and having the scientific method drilled into me, I remain skeptical of most of these advances, and I'm usually the last to jump on a bandwagon. Mm-hmm. And my sense is the artificial cervical disc is starting to revert to the mean. That is, this is a technology that is a bridge too far, that even though logically no one can argue with the theory of cervical disc arthroplasty, it makes sense, it's supposed to preserve motion. But yet again, the human body confounds the most enthusiastic sorts of engineers by the body actually seeking to fuse what is a mobile segment. So no, I am not an advocate of artificial cervical discs.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that.
Yep, thanks for your call, Bob.
Yeah.
Let's take another call. Jim, you're on line one. Jim, you with us? I think all right, Jim is off the air. So let me remind our listeners one more time how you might get in touch with us. We're going to be here another 15 minutes or so. My guest is Dr. Marius Maxwell. He's a neurosurgeon specializing in very interested in spine surgery, particularly newer techniques, but also taking a very critical look at the right patients and the right surgery for your problem. If you have questions or comments, you can reach us locally at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. I do have a question that came in by email, and this is perhaps a little bit out of line for both of us in our area of expertise, but I want to ask it anyway. This is a lady who is asking about osteoporosis. She's 67. She's had some bone density studies that show variable amounts of osteoporosis in different parts of her body. So let's say the spine is fine, but she has trouble in the neck of one of her femurs, and she wants to know, is it possible for some parts of the skeleton to fail to absorb calcium sufficiently while the rest of the skeleton is fine? Suggestions for treating osteoporosis. She says she's active. She takes calcium daily, 2,000 milligrams. Does resistant training and is of normal weight. So 67 years old, some evidence of osteoporosis by scan.
I would, I'm sure she takes lots of vitamin D. Let me say very clearly that I'm not a rheumatologist, and neurosurgeons do not manage osteoporosis unless there's a pathological fracture which becomes a neurosurgical problem. As you know, calcium metabolism is very intimately affected by vitamin D, and I'm sure this lady is taking vitamin D. I really can't. I'm really not expert to opine on whether different parts of the skeleton take up or lose calcium. Although I will share with you something, is that drinking milk, which is often believed to promote calcium, leads to calcium loss. It's quite interesting, because milk serves as an acid and actually acidifies the blood, and the body, in order to achieve a sort of homeostatic balance will leach a lot of calcium from the bones as a base. And so beware of quaffing large quantities of milk. I know this is flies against the received wisdom, but you might Google it and do your own research and get the data on that.
To the author of this email, I'm not going to put your name on board. I would answer the question. I think there is possibilities that there might be differential, but looking at the numbers you sent me, there may not be that much difference between the spine and the neck of your hip as you think, if you really looked at how this data is interpreted. And the second point is I can think of at least one situation where osteoporosis may be present more in one part or the other, and that's in a neurogenically injured leg. Someone with polio on one side of their lower leg would probably have some osteoporosis in that side relative to another because of the importance of use and muscles pulling on these bones is generating some of the metabolism of calcium and leading to the formation of osteoporosis and so forth. So the answer to your question is I think it is possible, but I'm not so sure you got that much difference between your different areas on the numbers that you sent me.
May I chip in very briefly?
Yeah, sure.
There is a very obvious neurosurgical component to osteoporosis, particularly in postmenopausal ladies who suffer compression fractures, which can be agonizing. And there is a minimally invasive spine procedure, which has been around for quite some time, called a kyphoplasty, which involves a percutaneous injection through the skin of a form of glue and cement into the vertebral body to take away the pain quite dramatically if it is an acute fracture. So that's certainly one dimension.
All right, good. Mike, you're on line one.
Yeah, hey. I had a cervical spine injury some years back. I'm 30 now. I was 23 at the time. And I had ruptured C4 and C5, the disc there. And at the time, I had a recommendation from a surgeon to fuse the spine. The MRI showed the ruptured disc, and that was what they were moving forward based on. This was a workers' comp claim. I was fighting it at the time, trying to get care. And eventually I got physical therapy and was recommended to a second opinion where they did a full motion x-ray and found there was considerably more damage to the cervical spine than just the rupture, which they had seen on the MRI. And so I was curious, you know, had I gone forward with that surgery, I never got it. You had mentioned the anterior fusing is a common, well-received procedure. You know, my concern was at 23, if I fused my neck, you know, what would the long-term consequences to my health be moving forward? So I guess I don't know how to word the question correctly.
Right.
But
right. Well, yeah, you, as I hear you asking the question is, what's the long-term risk of the anterior fusion? And I'm not a neurosurgeon, but I'm constantly reminding people it's not what the risk of the treatment is, it's what's the risk of the treatment and what's the risk of not treating. So let's see what Dr. Maxwell has to say.
If I understood the caller, he had an additional cervical spinal fracture in addition to the C3-4 disc problem?
There was the herniated disc, and then I had my facets were perched on each other. And there was a lot of soft tissue damage from C3 all the way down to, I think, C6.
Interesting. And you avoided surgery and have no pain, numbness, weakness in your arms?
I've lived with pain for 7 years, but it's off and on, and I do the physical therapy exercises, which has stopped the facets from reperching. They came unperched during the course of receiving physical therapy.
Well, I would hope that you're still being managed by some neurosurgeon who is following your progress.
No, it was a workers' comp thing, and I fought them, and they closed the claim. They said they'd keep medical open, but they denied my claim when I tried to go back to see someone. So I'm fighting them again.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. To explain to the listeners, the facets are the joints on the back of the spine, and certainly if you're 7 to 8 years after the injury, if your facets are still incompetent and perching means they slip out of position to juxtapose one on the other, certainly I would see a neurosurgical spine surgeon by hook or by crook, at least get evaluated. It makes me worried that 7 to 8 years you're still dealing with pain with what could be dynamic instability of your facet joint. So I would urge you to, you know, even if you go out of your own pocket, but at least see someone who can evaluate you, can do flexion extension films, get an MRI, and find out where you are 7 to 8 years out.
Now, with the anterior fusion, if I had opted for that, that was the recommendation they had prior to discovering the soft tissue damage and the rest of the stuff. If they had moved forward just based on the MRI, I mean, it seems like there could have been major negative consequences.
You know, it's difficult for me to say without seeing you, seeing your films, really sort of evaluating you, it's difficult to say. If your facets are still moving 7 to 8 years out, maybe a surgeon would have done this from behind to immobilize the facets. You can be fused from the front, anterior, or from behind, posterior. So okay. I'd hate to sort of give, you know, your entire body, the cervical spine at C3-4 is extremely critical level. So it seems to me that you have some instability, and I would urge you to see a neurosurgical spine surgeon as soon as you can. I just think that managing it yourself would worry me. The things you've told me worry me, so please don't take my... I couldn't advise you which surgery to get, because obviously I haven't seen your x-rays and MRIs and haven't examined you, but I would urge you to get qualified medical advice as soon as possible.
Thank you.
Mike, thanks for your call. Penny, you're on line one.
Hello.
Yeah, what can we do for you?
Well, about 15 years ago, I had spinal stenosis, and I had a surgery, a ray cage surgery, and it was like a miracle. It was dramatic, and I've been told lately that I was just lucky. Well, now, 15 years forward, I'm starting to have the same kind of pain going down my back and into my legs. And I was told that extra stress on the vertebrae above or below the one that was operated on is a common thing. Is that true? Do you know that? And what would you think I should do?
That's a very good question. Yes, what you're referring to is, the medical jargon is adjacent segment disease, that is adjacent to the level you had fused. Perhaps at your spinal stenosis, there was an offset or instability called a very big tongue-twisting name, that word that took me 20 years to get right, spondylolisthesis, whereby
I've heard it before.
Is that what you had, ma'am?
I can't say it, but I've okay. heard it, yes.
Is that what you were told that you had?
Yes.
Okay, so obviously Dr. Ray is one of the grand old men of neurosurgical spine surgery. Certainly you can have adjacent segment disease, which means after a fusion at a certain level, you may have wear and tear at the adjacent levels, i.e. the level above or below. If you're starting to get similar pain, I would go and see a neurosurgical spine surgeon and get an MRI. And the patient always knows best. If it's a pain that you identify and recognize, then I would think that it certainly is likely that you have stenosis at the next level. Certainly, we see stenosis above and below fusions quite a lot, and the time period sounds about right. But again, you might be fine. You might have very minimal stenosis, and you could just see a physical therapist or chiropractor and be well for years without additional surgery.
Okay, is the outcome of a surgery next to a previous surgery better or worse than if there wasn't one in the first place?
I would have to say just the same. I do a lot of revision surgery. I see a lot of people who've had previous back surgery previously, and adjacent segment surgery is very routine. And I think the outcome for you psychologically may be better. Assuming the surgery is the same, you will know what to expect, even more than the surgeon has, unless that surgeon has had spine surgery. So when I see people who've had back surgery before, I always joke that they know more about it than I do.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate
that. My pleasure.
Define for us the term spinal stenosis. What do you mean, and what are the symptoms that when that
spinal
happens?
Stenosis, lumbar spinal stenosis, which is very common in the lumbar spine,
the lower back
is a narrowing of the diameter of the spine. Now, the spine, the anatomy of the spine is the vertebral bodies in front, separated by the discs, which are the shock absorbers, and behind the vertebral bodies is a bony canal. It's rather like a hose, which stretches all the way up to the base of your skull, down to your tailbone. If this hose is pinched by degenerative arthritis, the facets that we were mentioning with the previous caller are on the back of the spine from your tailbone to the back of your neck. If you're getting arthritis, this basically is abnormal bone growth. And as these facets hypertrophy or become enlarged, they squeeze this tube which conveys the spinal cord, which ends about L1, L2 level. And then a beautiful term, which I've always thought is quite lovely, cauda equina, which is Latin for horse's tail. And imagine a horse's tail hanging in a tube of liquid, and that's what the spinal nerves look like. So when this tube is constricted around these nerves, you typically get lower back pain and leg pain, which worsens on walking. But then very typically, if people lean forward or sit down, the pain is abruptly alleviated. So I always ask my patients, how far can you walk at Walmart? When you've got a Costco with your wife, how far can you walk? And what I'm fishing for is they say, Doc, you know, I get my Walmart cart and I lean forward. And that's what the medical professionals call an anthropoid posture. As the patient leans forward as a fulcrum on the lower vertebral bodies, you stretch the posterior ligaments. And so you basically open up the tube. You unpinch the tube. So that's classical lumbar spinal stenosis symptoms. So if you're you can only walk to the mailbox and the pain is worsening, or if you're used to walking 5 miles, now can walk 2 blocks and the pain immediately goes when you're sitting or leaning forward, I'd be very suspicious of spinal stenosis.
Okay. I have to apologize. We have 2 people that are still holding, but we're in our last minute, and I have a preference to leave the last minute to our guests to tell us the important things they want us to remember from the program. What are the key 1 or 2 or 3 comments?
Well, I would say search carefully for your neurosurgical spine surgeon. Don't be blinded by technology and the internet. Go and see a professional. Have him evaluate you in patient, thoughtful way, and let him give you the options. Look for a doctor, I would say, who's experienced, trying to avoid someone right out of his training, because good judgment comes from experience, and experience, when we left our residencies, often we have to learn what works in our hands, and expect to find a doctor who'll spend a long time with you. If you're just seeing PAs or physician's assistants and not seeing the doctor, if your questions are not being answered, I would get a second opinion. And understand that the real determinant in this day of technology is the neurosurgical spine surgeon who will be your doctor.
Thanks very much. It's been a quick, enjoyable, educational hour for me. I very much appreciate your taking the time.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
My thanks to today's guest, Anchorage neurosurgeon Dr. Marius Maxwell of the Arctic Spine Clinic. If you want to continue this conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook, where you can find the link on our website, alaskapublic.org. Next week, Prentice Pemberton is going to be the host. We're going to talk about maternal mental health. He'll have a national and a local expert, so why don't you join him Monday, June 9th at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki was kind enough to monitor the web programs for us here and engineer today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.